From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Quentin Tarantino talks about writing and directing his new film, Django Unchained, a spaghetti western-inspired revenge film about an escaped slave who teams up with a bounty hunter against a plantation owner. It's a violent film, but Tarantino says,
what happened during slavery times is 1,000 times worse than I show. So if I were to show it 1,000 times worse, to me, that wouldn't be exploitive. That would just be how it is. If you can't take it, you can't take it.
Tarantino will also talk about growing up immersed in black popular culture. Then we'll listen back to an interview with actor Harry Carey Jr., who appeared in spaghetti westerns in the 70s and co-starred with John Wayne in the classic westerns She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, The Searchers, and Three Godfathers. He died last week. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Quentin Tarantino, whose new film Django Unchained opened Christmas Day. Tarantino is famous for writing and directing films that borrow from genres that he loves, crime, martial arts, westerns, war films, and turning them into what has almost become a genre you can call Tarantino. He wrote and directed Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, and Inglourious Basterds. Django Unchained pays tribute to spaghetti westerns. It's set in the South just a couple of years before the Civil War. Christoph Waltz, who played the Nazi known as the Jew Hunter in Inglourious Basterds, plays King Schultz, a dentist turned bounty hunter who frees a slave who can help him identify three white men he's tracking down. That slave, Django, is played by Jamie Foxx. Schultz and Django eventually go in search of Django's wife, who was sold to another plantation after she and Django had tried to escape. They soon figure out that she's now a slave on the plantation owned by Calvin Candy, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. To get access to the plantation, Django and Schultz pretend they want to purchase Candy's top Mandingo fighters. Mandingos are slaves who battle each other to the death for the entertainment of white people. This is the scene where Schultz and Django first meet Candy. Candy speaks first.
What's your name, boy?
His name is Django Freeman.
Why'd you dig him up?
Well, fortuitous turn of events brought Django and myself together.
I heard tell about you. I heard you've been telling everybody that Mandingos ain't no damn good. Ain't nothing nobody is selling is worth buying. I'm curious. What makes you such a Mandingo expert?
I'm curious what makes you so curious.
What did you say, boy?
Calm down, Butch. No offense given. None taken.
Monsieur Condi, I'd appreciate if you could direct your line of inquiry toward me.
One, you do not have anything to drink. Can I get you a tasty refreshment?
Yes, I'll have a beer.
Wunderbar. Roscoe, a beer for the man with the beard, and I will have a Polynesian pearl diver. Do not spare the rum.
Quentin Tarantino, welcome back to Fresh Air.
So good to be here.
It's great to have you. So the film is called Django Unchained, and Jamie Foxx plays Django. And the name Django comes from a series of spaghetti westerns in which the main character, I suppose, is called Django.
It's kind of an interesting history about those movies is after the Dollars trilogies came out and kind of created this entire new genre in Italy.
This is for a fist filled full of dollars, for a few dollars more. The Clint Eastwood,
and Good, Sergio, and the Bad, and the Ugly.
Good, Bad, and the Ugly, the Sergio Leone, Clint Eastwood movies.
Exactly. After that, made a cottage industry out of Rome and Almeria, Spain. Sergio Corbucci did his film Django, starring Franco Nero, in 1966, and it became a smash all throughout Europe and in particularly Asia and Latin America. And didn't play that well. It didn't play that much in America, and was actually banned until the 90s in England because it's so violent. In fact, it's actually kind of an interesting story. You couldn't see Django ever in England. The closest you could ever come to see Django in England was in the movie The Harder They Come with Jimmy Cliff. When Jimmy Cliff's on the run, he actually goes to a theater and watches Django.
Really? I saw that film so long ago, I never would have remembered that. Wow.
Yeah, the couple of scenes that you see of Django in The Harder They Come is the closest that Django ever got to playing in England. But the thing is, the movie, you know, it kicked up the violence and the surrealism and the brutality of spaghetti westerns to a new level. And it became so popular that there really only was one kind of genuine official sequel. It had Terence Hill playing the character, and Franco Rosati, one of the screenwriters, wrote that script. And you could tell it's obviously supposed to be the same guy, except maybe a little earlier. But all the other Django, there's about 40 of them. It's not the same character. They just call them Django just because the name became so popular. And sometimes there's not even a character named Django in the movie. They just threw Django in the title because the word Django meant so much. So I'm proud to say that we are in the long line of healthy tradition of unrelated Django ripoffs.
Well, you know, in my attempt to understand more about Django, I watched the beginning of two Django knockoffs. Because Shout Factory Records has just reissued like four Django films, none of them the original Corbucci one. So I watched the first few minutes of Django Kills Silently and Django's Cut Price Corpses. And I'll tell you, the first few minutes of each of those are really bad. One of them is kind of like Hercules meets the Three Stooges. And like you can see like none of the punches are connecting and the sound effects are really awful and the dialogue's really – there's like fight after fight after fight before you know who any of the characters are.
Well, you know, well, one thing that was actually funny is Franco Nero, from that point in time after Django through the 60s and all through the 70s, him and Alain Delon were like the two most popular leading men in Europe at that time. But the thing that was so funny was, in particularly in Germany, the Django movie was so popular that any movie that Franco Nero did was retitled Django something in Germany. He did a whole series of cop movies directed by Enzo G. Castellari, the guy who directed the original Inglourious Basterds, including one called High Crime, which was sort of their French connection and started a whole line of what they call policier movies in Italy. Well, but in Germany, it was called Django the Cop.
So in your Django movie, Django Unchained, Jamie Foxx is a slave who is freed during the course of the movie, and his name is Django. And the kind of catchphrase, the trademark phrase from the movie, somebody asks him in his name, and he says, Django, the D is silent.
Right.
That's great. So can you talk a little bit about coming up with that line? I doubt that line is in the original Django.
No, it's not. It was actually simply the fact that it seems like I thought everyone would know how to say the name Django, all right? You know, even if it wasn't from the spaghetti westerns, at least from Django Reinhardt, you would know how to say it. And people would read the script, oh, the Django Unchained, okay. And people would say it all the time. And frankly, I consider it an intelligence test. If you say the Django, you're definitely going down in my book. But where that actually came from was I came up with a cool bit, because actually Franco Nero's in the movie, and it's a sequence where we actually have the two Djangos in the same frame, both Jamie Foxx and Franco Nero. And so I have Franco look him up and down, ask him his name. Jamie says, Django, can you spell it? And then he spells the whole thing. And then after he gets through spelling it, I go, yeah, I had him say, the D is silent. And then Nero looks at him and says, I know. Little meta movie moment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Quentin Tarantino, and we're talking about his new movie, Django Unchained. Django Unchained is a revenge fantasy from the point of view of a freed slave. And so you're taking on slavery as an issue while paying homage to the spaghetti westerns, the Django spaghetti western. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't know, it's two types of movies that may or may not work very easily together. So what were the parts of those two genres, you know, like bounty hunter meets slavery, that you had trouble fitting together, and what worked that was easy to fit together?
I don't think I had, you know, for me, at least as far as I was concerned, I didn't have any trouble fitting them together. I mean, there's kind of two points in that, I think. One, I wanted to tell a Western story. And then two, I wanted to deal with America in the antebellum South during slavery times and show you America at that time and give it kind of an unblinking look at it. But, you know, when there hasn't been that many slave narratives in the last, you know, 40 years of cinema. And usually when they are, they're usually done on television. And for the most part, most of these TV movies or specials that come out are kind of what I call, they're historical movies, like history with a capital H. Basically, this happened, then this happened, then that happened, then this happened. And that can be fine well enough, but for the most part, I think they keep you at arm's length dramatically, because also there is this kind of level of good taste that they're trying to deal with about the history of the subject. And frankly, oftentimes they just feel like a dusty textbook just barely dramatized. Then there's other kinds of movies that have dealt with slavery in America, something like Goodbye Uncle Tom or Mandingo or Drum. Now, I actually think those movies get far, far closer to the truth. Having said that, the sensationalistic aspect and the almost exploitationistic aspect of the films can't be ignored, even though, like I said, I think they actually cut closer to the truth and cut closer to the bone. So what I wanted to do is I didn't want to go in either one of those directions. I wanted to tell the story as a genre movie, as an exciting adventure. And in this case, I wanted to do an exciting Western tale, an almost odyssey voyage that Django goes on, journey to free his wife from the clutches of an evil empire, but use antebellum South slavery as a backdrop for that adventure. And the whole idea of bringing up the bounty hunting thing, actually, I thought ended up working kind of brilliantly for what I was trying to tell, because I can't believe no one ever brought it up before, but Schultz brings it up. You know, in slavery, you have people selling human lives for cash. In the bounty hunting laws of the day, you have people selling corpses for cash.
My guest is Quentin Tarantino. We're talking about his new film, Django Unchained. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Quentin Tarantino, and his new movie is Django Unchained. Is it a coincidence, is it any coincidence that after taking on World War II and the Nazis in an Inglourious Bastards, you're set your new movie in the time of American slavery? So you've taken two absolutely horrible chapters in history, whereas, you know, your other films are contemporary, you know, set in contemporary times. Mm-hmm. So what made you want to take on just like two, just abhorrent chapters of history?
Because I actually thought they would be really good stories. I've had both stories in my head for a while. It just took them a while to sit in the incubator until they were ready. And Inglourious Basterds popped out first, and then it really set the stage for Django. But I like the idea of telling these stories and taking stories that oftentimes, if played out in the way that they're normally played out, just end up becoming soul deadening because you're just watching victimization all the time. And now you get a chance to put a spin on it and actually take a slave character, give him a heroic journey, make him heroic, make him give his payback, and actually show this epic journey and give it the kind of folkloric tale that it deserves, the kind of, you know, grand opera stage it deserves.
So there's a lot of violence in your movie. Slaves are being whipped and tortured, slaves forced to fight to the death like gladiators, lots of shooting and splatter. So what are your, how do I put this exactly? What are your limits for, like, what's your sensibility for how much splatter, how much violence, how much sadism? It feels like right, like it's part of the genre, like there's a certain like style to it that you're trying to express. And what's going to the point of like past where you want to go, to the point of like revulsion and exploitation to you know, to a degree that's just, I don't want to use the word immoral, but just, you know, bad.
Well, frankly, I mean, you know, what happened during slavery times is 1,000 times worse than I show. So if I were to show it 1,000 times worse, to me, that wouldn't be exploitive. That would just be how it is. If you can't take it, you can't take it. Now, I wasn't trying to do a Schindler's List, you are there under the barbed wire of Auschwitz kind of movie. I wanted the film to be more entertaining than that. Like I said, I wanted it to be an exciting adventure movie. But there's two types of violences in this film. There's the brutal reality of the violence that that slaves lived under the slavery laws for 245 years. And then there's the violence of Django's retribution, and that's movie violence. And that's fun. And that's cool. And that's really enjoyable. It's kind of what you're waiting for. And it's actually paying back the pain that you had to watch to get there. And so there are two different type of aesthetics going on. And I wanted the painful violence of the slavery sections to hurt and to be painful. Now, here's the deal. I could handle a lot more than I put in this movie. I have a tolerance for viscera more than the average person. So I could have actually handled it a lot more. And in, like, as I was cutting the movie, earlier versions of it had more in there. But when I started watching it with finally when I started showing it in front of audiences, I have a lot of different emotions I want you to kind of get to in the course of this movie. And one of the emotions I want you to get to at the end is cheering Django. I want you to cheer his triumphs at the end and you know, be rooting for him and actually cheer. And if you don't cheer at the end, I haven't done the job. I haven't pulled off the movie I was trying to pull off. I mean, it's very easy for me if I've failed or succeeded. If the audience cheers at the end, I've succeeded. If they don't cheer, or if it's a qualified cheer, maybe I haven't failed, but it was a qualified response, and this house didn't go with it as much as I thought they should have. As much as they were supposed to. So it's a very clear choice of, you know, did I do it, did I not do it? And when I watched it with, you know, those rougher scenes like the Mandingo scene or the dog scene or the castration scene, when they were rougher, I traumatized the audience too much. They were too traumatized. So the responses in all the other sections of the film were qualified by that trauma.
Well, I think when you're watching the film, the audience isn't thinking like you're thinking, because you're thinking like there's the reality violence and then there's the fun genre violence.
Oh, I think they are. I think they are. Yeah? I totally think they are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally think they are. One, there's the violence that's hard to watch, and there's the violence that's fun to watch. I think they're totally thinking that.
So what was it like for you to be in the position of having people dress as slaves and then making them act like they're fighting to the death, like a dog fight, and dressing other people as slaves and having them get whipped? So, was that a little awkward?
Well, it wasn't awkward so much as it was, you know, it was painful. It was a little painful. I mean, when we actually started doing it, it was fine because we knew what we were doing and everyone knew what we were doing. We're making a movie. Everyone knows what's going on. You know, put a bunch of black folks dressed as slaves in a cotton field. They're picking cotton. Then there's a break. Okay, cut. And then, you know, you give them coconut water or something. They're eating power bars. You know, so it's like you're making a movie. You know what time it is. But after I wrote the script, thinking about it, it was something that I was, frankly, had trepidation about doing. You know, it's one thing to write on a piece of paper, 100 slaves are marched through the mud wearing metal collars and in chains and with metal masks like mad dogs, being moved around by white people on horses and with shotguns. And it's another thing to actually have 100 black folks get dressed in these clothes and march through the mud that way in this slave auction town that you've built, or putting them in the background and planting up a cotton field and putting them in the field and having them work under a broiling sun. And I had a little trepidation about it and was actually trying to think of some way that maybe I could escape the pain of asking Americans to do that. And, I thought one point of maybe I could shoot it in the West Indies, that those sections, or maybe shoot it in Brazil or something, because, they have their own history, but it wouldn't be an American history. So there would be this once removed quality to it. And then it was funny. I actually went out after I finished the script. I went out with Sidney Poitier for dinner and was telling him about my story and then telling him about my trepidation and my little plan of how I was going to get past it. And he said, "Quentin, I don't think you should do that. I think basically what you're just telling me is you're a little afraid of your own movie, and you just need to get over that." If you're going to tell this story, you need to not be afraid of it. You need to do it. Everyone gets it. Everyone knows what's going on. We're making a movie. They get it. Just treat everybody with the right kind of compassion as I know you will, then you have nothing to be worried about.
Quentin Tarantino will be back in the second half of the show. His new film is Django Unchained. Here's one of the songs from the soundtrack that actually comes from the original 1966 movie, Django. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Celebrating Fresh Air's 25 years, the Neubauer Foundation salutes WHYY and listeners like you, committed to new ideas and civilized conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from IFC, back with Portlandia, starring Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein. New episodes Friday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern on IFC. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And from Ancestry.com, an online resource for starting a family tree and getting clues to the past. Learn more at tryancestry.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, why Quentin Tarantino's home life as a child was sometimes like a sitcom, and how he grew up immersed in Black popular culture. And we'll listen back to a 1989 interview with actor Harry Carey Jr., who appeared with John Wayne in the classic John Ford westerns She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, Wagon Master, and The Searchers. Harry Carey Jr. died last week. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Quentin Tarantino, who wrote and directed the films Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, and Inglourious Basterds. His new film, Django Unchained, is a revenge movie inspired by spaghetti westerns. It's set in the South a couple of years before the Civil War. Christoph Waltz plays a bounty hunter who frees a slave named Django, played by Jamie Foxx, and makes him his partner. Eventually, they go in search of Django's wife, who was recently sold to a notoriously brutal plantation owner. We recorded our interview December 21st, right before we began our series of holiday programs. There's a part of the Western genre and the spaghetti Western genre that's about sadism, you know, where, and a line from your film that I'm thinking of and is like, no, don't shoot them. It's too simple for these men. So yeah. The implication is not shooting them. It's an easy death. You got to torture them first.
Yeah,
and
there,
I grew up on so many Westerns where that was just like a part of it. And of course, two things happen. First, there's the opportunity for some torture. And in a lot of Westerns, that's very lightweight, like not allowing them to drink in the desert or something. In others, it's much more rougher stuff. But then there's also the opportunity for escape because you're not killing them. So that gives them time to get free.
Well, there actually is this, you know, that there actually is this thing in spaghetti Westerns. It's almost a ritual trial by fire that usually happens to the spaghetti Western hero. At some point, he's captured by the villains.
Right.
And he's given a Passion of Christ beating at the hands of the bad guys. And then he gets away and rains down vengeance on them. It's kind of part and parcel to the spaghetti Western. You even call it a spaghetti Western beating.
And what do you like about that?
What do I like about it?
Mm-hmm.
That's fun.
So I just have to ask you, is it any less fun after, like, the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary? Like, do you ever go through a period where you lose your taste for movie violence? And movie violence is not real violence. I understand the difference. But still, are there times when it just is not a fun movie experience for you, either to be making it that way or to be in the audience for something like that?
Not for me.
So it's so completely separate that the reality of violence doesn't affect at all your feelings about making or viewing very violent or sadistic.
Sadistic? I don't know. I don't know. You're putting a judgment on it.
No. The characters are sadistic. I'm not talking about, you know, the filmmaker. I'm talking about the characters. I mean, the characters are undeniably sadistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you say after the tragedy, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well.
Do you mean on that day would I watch The Wild Bunch? Maybe not on that day.
Or in the next few days, like while it's still really fresh in your reality.
Would I watch a kung fu movie 3 days after the Sandy Hook massacre? Would I watch a kung fu movie? Maybe, because they have nothing to do with each other.
You sound annoyed that I'm.
Yeah,
I know you've been asked this a lot.
Yeah, I'm really annoyed. I think it's disrespectful. I think it's disrespectful to their memory, actually.
Which, whose memory?
The memory of the people who died, to talk about movies. I think it's totally disrespectful to their memory. Obviously, the issue is gun control and mental health.
Just one other related question. Did you ever, because I know you really enjoy, have always enjoyed really violent movies, have you ever been exposed to a movie image, even when you were a child or as an adult, that you wished you hadn't seen because it was so troubling and scary and you had nightmares about it and haunted you?
Well, you make that's not supposed to happen. Like, that would be a bad thing.
Not passing value judgment, just asking.
Yeah, well, let me just say this.
Some of my favorite movies from childhood terrified me, but...
Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah, I mean, here's just kind of where I'm coming from, is I've been asked this question for 20 years.
Which question?
About the effects of violence in movies relating to violence in real life. And my answer is the same 20 years ago. It hasn't changed one iota.
And it's the answer you just gave?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I don't know what I just said, but obviously I don't agree. I don't think one has to do with the other.
Right. So this question is kind of separate from all of that. The question about images that haunted you. So let's define this as a different chapter. But I'll give you a for instance. When I was growing up in New York, the first time the Charles Laughton version of The Hunchback of Notre Dame came on Million Dollar Movie, I was mm-hmm. absolutely terrified. I forced my family to change the channel and put on Texas Rangers because just the sight of Charles Laughton's face was so horrifying mm-hmm. to me, because he has a very, you know, disfigured face in the film. And it's set in, like, you know, medieval times, and the whole thing just terrified me. And then it was a Million Dollar Movie, so it was repeated like several times every day yeah. for a week. And I found like I had to keep putting on the TV, and every day I'd watch more of it. And to this day, mm-hmm. it is one of my favorite movies. I mean, I think it is just an absolutely beautiful film in every way. But it started off as being terrifying for me and filled with images that scared me. So I'm just wondering about the correlation in your mind between images that you found frightening and movies you ended mm-hmm. up liking, or images that maybe you wish you'd never seen.
The only thing that I've ever watched in a movie that I wished I'd never seen is real-life animal death or real-life insect death in a movie. That's absolutely positively where I draw the line. And a lot of European and Asian movies do that. And we even did that in America for a little bit of time. I don't like seeing horses being yanked on cables from running W's. I don't like seeing animals murdered on screen. Movies are about make-believe. It's about imagination. Part of the thing is we're trying to create a realistic experience, but we are faking it. And it's the faking it is the art. The faking it is the it's the art of it. It's the make-believe of it all. I don't think that there's any place in a movie for real death. And you can say, Peckinpah shot the heads off the chickens in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, but it's okay because they ate the chickens afterwards. And actually, maybe those chickens got three more days of life because they were taken out of a slaughterhouse and everything. Well, you can justify it in that way because people eat chicken and I eat chicken, so all good. I don't want to see real death, though. That's the problem. It's the watching of the real chicken get his real head blown off. I don't pay money, or I don't want to sit down and watch real death when I watch a movie. I don't even want to see an animal terrified. I've seen movies where they've terrified an animal to get a response from him, and I don't want to see that.
You want to see artifice. You don't want to see genuine pain.
Yes, it's
or
make-believe.
Or torture or death.
Exactly. It's make-believe.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Quentin Tarantino. We're talking about the new film that he wrote and directed called Django Unchained. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Quentin Tarantino. We're talking about the new movie that he wrote and directed, Django Unchained. So let's just talk Westerns for a minute. What are some mm-hmm. of your favorite all-time American Westerns?
Some of my favorite American Westerns, you know, I like every era of Westerns in America. One of the things that's interesting about Westerns in particular is there's no other genre that reflects the decade that they were made and the morals and the feelings of Americans during that decade than Westerns. Westerns are always a magnifying glass as far as that's concerned. You know, so, you know, the Westerns of the 50s definitely have an Eisenhower birth of suburbia and plentiful times aspect to them. America started little by little catching up with its racist past by the 50s at the very, very, very beginning of it. And that started being reflected in Westerns. Consequently, the late 60s have a very Vietnam vibe to the Westerns leading into the 70s. And by the mid 70s, you know, most of the Westerns literally could be called Watergate Westerns, because it was about a disillusionment and tearing down the myths that we have spent so much time building up. So some of my favorite Westerns, kind of off the top of my head, American Westerns, I love Anthony Mann's Westerns, but in particular Winchester 73. That's one of my favorite. Yeah, Jimmy Stewart. And especially the episodic structure, the way you follow the rifle, you know, from owner to owner and owner. The fact that it's all kind of episodic and vignette-y is really terrific. I love Robert Aldrich's Vera Cruz. I'm a big, big fan of Don Siegel's Western Flaming Star with Elvis Presley, which I actually think is maybe the most violent Western made in the 50s. Very similar to a 70s Western in that regards. And I love Marlon Brando's One-Eyed Jacks. And I love a ton of Westerns from the 70s. I love Little Big Man. I actually think Little Big Man actually has a bit of a symbiotic relationship to Django Unchained to some degree.
Now, I've read in a couple of places you saying that you think you might retire from movie making when you hit 60, in part because you want to, you know, have more of a life than you can have when you're obsessed with making movies. But also, you don't want to make those kind of old man end of your career movies that aren't very good, and you know, and that bothered me a little bit because here's why. I think that part of what I interpreted you as saying is that you didn't want to make movies that would be older, that would reflect being older. And I think, like, I want to know who the older Quentin Tarantino, when you hit 60, I want to know who you are and what you're interested in. I want to see if your sensibility has changed, and if it has, what's it changed into? I want you to feel free to get older and to experience any change that may or may not bring in your sensibility, and to go with it.
Well, you will. I just won't be making movies. I'll be writing. Writing novels. I'll be writing novels. I'll be writing film criticism and everything. Books on cinema. So my artistic life won't stop. It'll just change. I'll become a man of letters. you'll probably get far more into my psyche than you get right now, because that's all I have to do.
So here's something I was wondering. I know there's so much, like, you know, African American popular culture that you really love. And I was wondering, when you were growing up, if you grew up in an integrated neighborhood, if you went to an integrated school, if you had African American friends, or if your contact with Black people was largely through popular culture.
No, I went to a mostly Black school. It wasn't all Black because I was there, but it was mostly Black. And at different points in my life, I was raised by Black people, raised in black homes, between my mom's best friend that I lived a lot of times with, her and her family, and just the kind of United Nations aspect that my mom's house was in the early 70s, right at the explosion of Black culture. So Black culture is my culture growing up.
Your mother had a United Nations kind of home?
Yeah. Well, it was almost like a sitcom, actually, the way we lived in the 70s, because she was in her 20s. She was hot, all right? And she was a hot white girl. Her best friend was named Jackie. She was a hot Black girl, and her other best friend was Lillian, and she was a hot Mexican girl. And they lived in this, like, swinging singles apartment with me.
What impact did that have on you?
Yeah, well, it was just, and it was in the 70s. So it was, you know, I lived with these three hip ladies all going out on dates all the time, and dating football players and basketball players. And,
professional, you know, ones?
No, my mom dated Wilt Chamberlain. She's one of the thousand.
No, Rich,
one of
the Did that, this is getting too personal, but did that affect your sense of sexuality when you were growing up?
In what way?
Well, because so many people can't imagine their parents having sex. And when you're growing up with, like, your mother and two other women who are obviously engaging, you know, it makes you think of your...
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. It was just, you know, she was a woman. She was living the life. She was having a good time and everything, you know, just taking care of me too. So everything was fine. It was hip. It was just cool. You know, the boyfriends had come over, and they take me to blaxploitation movies, trying to, you know, get me to like them and buy me footballs and stuff. And we'd go to, like, cool, you know, my mom and her friends would take me to cool bars and stuff, where they'd be playing cool live rhythm and blues music, and I'd be drinking Shirley Temples. I think I called them James Bond because I didn't like the I didn't like the name Shirley Temple. I drink Shirley Temples and, you know, eat Mexican food or whatever, while it's like some, you know, Jimmy Soul and a cool band would be, you know, playing in some lava loungy kind of 70s cocktail lounge. It was really cool. It made me grow up in a real big way. I was when I would hang around with kids, I'd think they were really childish. I was used to hanging around with like really groovy adults.
Oh, I feel like I know you're just a little bit better now.
Yeah, at Saturday, Saturday, every time Saturday would roll around, it'd become 1 o'clock. Everyone in the house watched Soul Train.
Great. Okay, so one last question, because I know you have to go. I know you bought a movie theater in LA. What's your dream movie theater? Like, if you could design a movie theater from scratch, what would it be?
Oh gosh, I don't know if I'd really want to spend the money to build.
You don't have to spend the money. It's a dream movie theater. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, but I mean, but I would be more inclined to actually take over some cool, more historical theater or something like that. I mean, I guess a dream movie theater for me would be if I owned the Castro. In San Francisco. That would be awesome.
To own the Castro would be cool. Organ in there, and yeah.
Oh yeah, that would be awesome. That would be cool to own the Castro. That would be my dream movie theater.
Right. Yeah. Great. Great. Okay.
I mean, I guess maybe the Cinerama Dome too. All right. If we're gonna really dream.
And what's your own movie theater like?
Oh, it's a little shoebox.
Oh, okay.
I'd like to do so much stuff there, but I can't because it's just so small. All right. But it's lovely in its tackiness. But it's genuine. It's a cool little single house movie theater, really nice and cute and modest, and always shows 35mm. Except right now, oddly enough, because they're playing Django, the original Django, and they only have a digital thing. And they actually had to ask my permission to show something digital there. And I broke down and gave it on this one instance.
You've compromised.
This one instance and this one instance alone.
Well, Quentin Tarantino, it was great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Terry.
Quentin Tarantino wrote and directed the new film Django Unchained. You can see clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, an interview from our archive with Harry Carey Jr., who died last week. He appeared with John Wayne in several classic John Ford westerns. This is Fresh Air. The actor Harry Carey Jr., who's best known for appearing in westerns, died last Thursday at the age of 91. We're going to listen back to a 1989 interview with him. His father, Harry Carey Sr., was one of Hollywood's first western movie stars, best known for his roles in John Ford films. Carey Sr. died in 1947, but his son continued the family tradition. Harry Carey Jr. became a regular character in Ford's stock company, appearing in 9 Ford films, including Rio Grande, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and Wagon Master. Carey's first Ford film was The Three Godfathers with John Wayne.
I grew up watching westerns all the time, both movie westerns and television westerns. And I could tell you it was my ambition in life when I was young to be a cowboy. You grew up the son of a cowboy star, you know, a star of westerns.
Yeah.
Did you want to be a cowboy when you grew up? Did you ever have those kinds of fantasies?
Yeah, well, when I was in my teens, I wanted to be a racehorse trainer. And my idol, equine idol, was Seabiscuit, who was a very famous racehorse. And much to my dad's chagrin, I mean, he wanted me to be, you know, to start roping and And he said, you don't wear your boots enough. You don't wear your cowboy hat. You're always riding around in your tennis shoes and stuff. And finally, when I was about 19, I met a great cowboy. He was a world champion. His name was Andy Waregi. He was a Spanish Basque. And he became my hero. And he taught me to rope. And then I got cowboy nuts. And my father was very proud of that.
What was one of the most challenging action scenes that you were in?
Well, that was in the picture called Rio Grande. There's some what they call Roman teams. That's two horses linked together, and you leap on one, and then when they start to run, you get up on stand on top of them and ride the two horses. It's called Roman riding.
This is one leg on each horse?
One foot on each horse. You're standing up. It's like water skiing on horses.
Right.
And so, anyway, that was the most challenging, because we had to learn that before the picture started. You just don't do that. The main reason is, even though we were in our 20s, your legs just give out. And your first instinct when you get on the horses, who are broken to do that, is to bend your knees and be in a squatted position all the time, because you feel safer that way. But actually, when you get better at it, you begin to straighten up more. So your legs just give out when you first start doing it. So we did it for 3 weeks before the picture started, and I think that was the most challenging physical thing that we had to do horseback-wise.
Can you give me a sense of what it's like to be in the middle of one of those epic scenes with the cavalry versus the Indians and a lot of, you know, horses charging?
Yeah. Well, we loved it. It's sort of like, I imagine, a good athlete feels the same feeling before a baseball or a football game. It's a challenge, and the unexpected is always the best. Ford was very lucky that way. I think he got the best action of any director I've ever worked for.
Were you ever hurt?
But it was a wonderful feeling before a scene like that, because in those days they didn't have the walkie-talkie things, you know, like they have in all the war pictures now, and the ADs, the assistant directors, carry these, you know, on their belts. And they can talk, even if they're 2 miles away from the camera, they can talk to the director. In those days, you rode out to wherever you were before the stampede or before the big cavalry charge, and you'd be like a half a mile or a quarter of a mile away from the director. And then you just have to wait until you heard a gunshot. And then when the director shot the gun off, then you started charging. It was a great feeling. It was very exhilarating.
Well, how are these things choreographed? Like, how much would you rehearse it? And how well would it actually work in the final shoot? Because it seems like it would so easily become chaos in one of the big battle scenes.
Well, Ford didn't rehearse those things. You can't when you've got that many horses and Indians and cavalry and everything involved. But he had a tremendous talent and gift for communicating with large groups of people. And even though he could be tough personally, one-on-one with actors, I mean, he picked on John Wayne a lot. He was marvelous with the extras and with the Indians and with the Navajos and all of the extra guys that they hired out on locations like up in Moab or Monument Valley, wherever. And they all got to know him like he made them feel like they were playing a very important role in the picture. And so he had them so keyed up, like a really great football coach with a football team. He'd have them so organized and told everybody exactly what he wanted. It was all clear in all of our minds, and then you just couldn't wait to do it. And when you heard that gunshot, all hell broke loose, you know. He'd always have like six cameras or five cameras on a scene like that. You know, he just didn't rely on one camera. You know, he'd have them stuck all around on top of hills and everything so that he could get intercut with different things.
Say it was one of these big chaotic battle scenes. Did you know who you were supposed to be shooting or who was supposed to be shooting you?
No, and one of the things that happened, like when you, Western actors finally got, you know, you use blanks, of course, I'm sure you know, but when you get on location, you're using local kids or local guys, and they get these blank pistols and you can get hurt with it, powder burns, you know, and this big wad comes out and hits you right in the eye or in the forehead. And I've seen guys look right at you and then shoot you, you know. And Wayne would always make a big speech. He'd say, shoot in an empty space, because on the camera it doesn't look like you're, you know, it looks like you're aiming at somebody. But he said, don't point your guns at another person. Shoot at the empty spaces. But they never heard, you know, and you had to be careful because somebody would shoot you right in the face.
You've been doing spaghetti westerns in Italy?
I did a couple of them, yeah.
Was that fun? They must think of you as, like, really authentic because you were in classic American westerns.
They treated me terrific over there. You know, I wasn't a lead like, you know, Clint was or anything. It was just, I played, they had a big star there called Terrence Hill. And I played his dad in a couple of shows. And then I did another one with Franco Nero called The Return of White Fang. It was a lot of fun. We made it in Austria.
Harry Carey Jr. recorded in 1989. He died last Thursday at the age of 91. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shaw. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by dobro player Mike Aldridge. He died Saturday at the age of 73. He was best known for his work with the band Seldom Seen. Just a few months ago, he won a National Endowment for the Arts National Heritage Fellowship.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Republic Records, with selections from the Les Miserables soundtrack, including I Dreamed a Dream and Suddenly, available now. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR.
The largest al-Qaeda-held territory in the world is in northern Mali, where Islamic extremists seize control in April and are terrifying the population by performing amputations as punishments. Islamic extremists now have a sanctuary there. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Adam Nossiter, the New York Times West Africa Bureau Chief. Join us.